Dear brothers and sisters, Namo Buddhaya. So I'm very pleased indeed to make my re-entry into the LBC after pretty much 5 years of complete absence. It does coincide with Paramabandhu's chairmanship, but nothing should be read into that. And in fact, I feel rather sad that I wasn't there wasn't on site, so to speak, to support him in his chairmanship. He didn't need it. I have been rather busy the last few years, and particularly over the last couple of years, I've been trying to spend much more time in retreat, as well as spend more time in India. I'm quite active in the conversion movement amongst so-called ex-untouchables in India, and that's a very important part of my life. But I've concluded that I want to put more effort back into the West, and the LBC is a place that's very dear to me, and so this is my re-entry, if you want me. It's up to you in the end. So we're here together to commemorate, to remember, to reflect upon what for us as Buddhists is the most important event in history. And we need to savour that, the most important event in history. For us, as Buddhists, history pivots on the point at which the Buddha gained enlightenment. There's before and there's after. Something new came into history with the Buddha's gaining of enlightenment. It's had a massive effect on the whole world. Of course, Buddhism is very much on the defensive in the old Buddhist world, and in many ways is you could say even not dying but severely sick in much of the old Buddhist world. But it's had a huge influence on so many cultures. Well, for instance, in India, Buddhism died out pretty much effectively about 800 years ago. There are some traces of Buddhism even today, which I'll talk about later, but it died out about 800 years ago. But the influence of Buddhism in India is still very much present. You can read in modern Hinduism quite strong influence from Buddhism. And modern Hinduism, it's often said, is actually a reconstruction on the basis of Buddhism. It has had a massive effect all over the world, and today, even in the modern West, you'll find that many people have heard of Buddhism, are influenced by Buddhist ideas, even if they don't understand them or don't really know what they are. It's had a huge effect on the world, and it's, yes, still having that effect. Buddhism is reawakening in some of the old Buddhist East. In China itself, Buddhism is coming back to life in a much more radical and effective way, I've heard. In India, there's this massive movement of conversion, which could involve still hundreds of millions of people, literally. I travel around in North India, and what I'm seeing there is the movement started by Dr. Ambedkar 50 years ago is having a new lease of life. If anybody's aware of it, there are elections going on in India at the moment, and one of the major parties standing for election is explicitly Buddhist. The Buddha is on all their posters and so forth. I mean, how you can have a political party that's Buddhist is another question, but we won't go into that now. But they're inspired by Buddhist ideas, ideals, and the leader of that party, the redoubtable Miss Mayawati, has said that if she becomes Prime Minister of India, she will convert to Buddhism. If she does, you're talking about 300 million people coming into Buddhism. So the effect of Buddhism, you know, it's a bit as if it's sort of gone to sleep a bit as if the fire has dampened down, but the spark is still there, very, very much alive under the surface of things, even here in the East End of London, at the London Buddhist Centre. And it's wonderful that you've expanded this centre. Last night, I want to correct something Maitreya Bandhu said. It's quite a lot I want to correct, but I want to correct one. Just one thing in particular. He said, well, now we finished the work that was started 30 years ago. Don't you believe it? In 30 years' time, hubris will pay you back. You'll be standing there while some whippersnapper talks about completing your work. now we have this wonderful, wonderful expanded centre, you know, at one stage in its completion. You've got a remarkable base for communicating the Dhamma much, much more widely, much, much more vigorously. I have some fears myself. Oh dear, I'm going off script already and I haven't even started. I have some fears myself that the sort of momentum's slightly been lost. Siddhi Ratner sitting there in front of me. We remember the old days, the revolutionary days, when we really were, you know, after we decided that acid in the water supply wasn't going to do it. we thought that if we could just get the Dhamma across to enough people, the revolution would happen. We're still waiting. The Buddhism has, the momentum of the growth of Buddhism has definitely slowed, and perhaps it's become a little more staid. And I'd certainly like myself to see a new and radical spirit of Buddhism generated here. But that more anon. So yes, this extraordinary event, 2,500 and more years ago, I can never remember the exact figure, is for us the pivotal event in history. From that event, everything unfolds, and everything before led up to it. So today is the day for remembering that moment and taking ourselves back to it and trying to sort of really connect with what happened. Well, even you could say connect with the Buddha. We're supposed to be meeting the Buddha. So we're having to meet the Buddha in imagination. So let's go back to that time, that extraordinary period when history changed. We can do it because we've got quite a lot of material about what happened. Although it's not clear exactly what is historically accurate and what is mythological and so forth. But putting it all together, we can get a pretty good idea of what went on for the Buddha during a whole seven-week period. We're very familiar with what happened under the Bodhi tree, at least in theory. But actually we know quite a bit about the whole period that he was there at Bodh Gaya. And so I want to explore that and try to go into what was going on in his mind, as far as we can, in all humility, what the different events mean for us, so that we can really meet the Buddha, through identifying with what he was going through and what he did at that time, what he realised at that time. I've just come back from Bodh Gaya, as a number of order members here have, and I spent three remarkable weeks there, a week of which was at the International Order Convention of the Western Buddhist Order, Trailokya Bauddha Mahasangha, a week on retreat with Indians, and a week at another meeting. And every day I was going to the Bodhi tree and sitting in front of the Bodhi tree and tuning in, as it were, to what happened there all those years ago. And I found myself more and more able to be there with the Buddha, feel that I was actually there with the Buddha at that moment of realisation. And I had some quite extraordinary experiences there, just in simple terms. For instance, with the whole of all my brothers and sisters in the order, prostrating in front of the refuge tree. 500 of us prostrating in front of the refuge tree. I had the experience of leading a Dhamma Mitra ceremony for an Indian and a Tibetan in front of the Bodhi tree. It was a sort of humbling experience in many ways to be there in that spot, carrying out that function, as it were, on behalf of the Buddha. So the Bodh Gaya is very much in my heart, very much in my mind, and I feel very strongly connected with what took place there as a physical location, a moment in history. So let's just recapitulate. Let's lead the Buddha up to the moment when he comes to Bodh Gaya. We remember that he had some sort of luxurious upbringing. What exactly it was, it's not really possible to say any longer. He had an experience of disillusionment. He says that he felt cramped. He felt narrowed. He felt confined. And he could not experience happiness, he could not experience peace in the kind of life that he was living at home. So he went forth in the time-honoured Indian manner, which people still do today. Cut off his hair, took off his rich clothes, put on rag robes, and wandered in the forest looking for a solution to the deep problem, the deep frustration that he felt, the deep sense of confinement, restriction, dissatisfaction that he felt, the sense that nothing really adds up, doesn't really mean anything, it doesn't really bear the weight of one's intelligence, of one's feeling. It's not able to sustain one's human being, you could say. It doesn't really give you a means of completely living out freely this life that you're given. And he wandered, he found various teachers. Those teachers took him so far, and in each case he went all the way with those teachers and then became disillusioned. He realised that they had not taken him to the point that he wanted to get to, although he didn't know what it was. He knew that what he was being given was not adequate to him. So one of the great things about the Buddha, I think, is that he obeys his dissatisfaction all his life. I think it's a very, very important thing for any human being is to pay attention to your dissatisfaction. I don't mean your disgruntlement with not getting things the way you want them. There's plenty of that. But your sense that you're in a cage, that you know, the bars of the cage are too near. There's nowhere for you to really expand yourself. You're not getting the answers that you need. It's a very, very important experience for us. I think probably you could say the fundamental basis of spiritual life is this experience of dissatisfaction, the sense of discontent, the refusal to take second best, and the decision to seek real and deep solutions to the problems that confront one, the existential problems that confront one. And the Buddha exemplifies this to a very, very high degree, well, to the supreme degree. He was satisfied with nothing less than fulfillment, full fulfillment, completion. So he didn't take even the wonderful teachers that he had, he didn't find himself satisfied with that. They offered him position, he wouldn't take it. They offered him joint leadership, he wouldn't take it. It did not satisfy this deep sense of frustration, this energy that was not fulfilled. So off he went. He tried the time-honoured method of Indian spiritual quest, austerity. And we're told that he outdid everybody in austerity. In the scriptures it says that he was down to one grain of rice a day. And there's a wonderful Buddhist joke. The scriptures are actually full of jokes. Most people take them thoroughly seriously, and the Abhidhamma has you know, spent a lot of time explaining all the jokes, but I think they're just jokes. So the Buddha says, and don't think that a grain of rice was any bigger then than it is now. So he's down to one grain of rice a day. And there are statues of him, the famous statues of him, where he's just a skeleton with you know, the veins sticking out, and a skull-like face, with eyes right deep set in his skull. And he realised that this just was not getting him nowhere. All it was going to do was get him dead. You can't think when you're that weak. You can't reflect. Your mind won't still. You're just a faint flicker of life. So he abandoned that in the course of that disillusioning the disciples that he'd gathered around him. And he remembered an experience that he'd had as a child. It remembered an experience of simply sitting quietly by himself and becoming extremely concentrated and very, very happy. And he thought, well, that's the basis for investigation of things. That's the basis for seeing things. When your mind is turbulent, when your mind is disturbed, you can't see clearly. It's a common experience that we all have. You know, the worst time to make decisions is when you're emotionally upset. And even if the Buddha wouldn't have been upset in that sense, if your mind is not still, if your mind is not happy, you can't really see things clearly because you're simply externalizing your own disturbance. So he realized that he needed to, first of all, still his mind, concentrate his mind, focus his mind. And being an exceptionally highly positive individual, he was able to do that relatively easily. So he took some food from a cowgirl, Sujata. He took some milk rice from her. And he arrived at Bodh Gaya. And, you know, now Bodh Gaya is a rather seedy sort of pilgrimage centre with quite a number of temples, but it, in itself it's not a particularly attractive place. But at that time it had just been jungle. There probably wouldn't have been any huts there or anything like that at all. Gaya was the main centre. That was a big pilgrimage centre, but Bodh Gaya is 20 miles away. And there would probably be nothing there, just the Mahavana, the great jungle that covered the whole of India at that time. And he realised that this was a good place. It was quiet. There was a beautiful tree to sit under. Nobody coming by. Water was nearby from in the river. And so he just sat down under the Bodhi tree. The tree that is there now is the great grand tree, great grand seedling of the original tree, so we're told. It was cut down in the 3rd century and BC. But a sprout was taken to Sri Lanka, and from that a sprout has gone back to Bodh Gaya. So he sat under that tree, and he deeply concentrated his mind. So the events that took place from then on are spread over 7 weeks. So and they're, you know, rather perhaps schematically dealt with week by week. For 1 week he was here, for 1 week there, another week there. He probably didn't have a watch, he probably wasn't keeping track of the days of the week, so take 7 times 7 symbolically. But anyway, something like this happened. For 1 week he sat under that Bodhi tree and first of all concentrating his mind and entering deeply into dhyana. So it said, and it said that at that point something arose within his mind, or he's confronted by something. This is often very dramatically expressed in Buddhist scriptures. You all know it, of course, the attack of Mara. I'm not going to describe it, I'm not going to go into all the details, but Mara assailed him. Mara representing, I suppose, all the forces that seek compromise. All the forces in your own mind that lead you away from fully facing up to the way life is. Everything that offers you a false solution, false refuges, you could say. Things that it seems as if you embrace these, you will find relief from the tensions, the suffering, the pain of life. Mara represents that. You know, sometimes he's talked about as the Buddhist Satan. That's to cast it in completely the wrong context. It puts it in the context of a cosmic battle of good and evil. That's just not a Buddhist way of looking at things. Mara represents everything within you, everything within life, that tries to take you away from what really is. Everything that offers to you a sort of a seeming solution. And there are so many of them. We're constantly confronted by lesser goals, lesser achievements, as representing some sort of solution for us. Well, the most obvious one, and the one that's most graphically represented, no doubt for prurient reasons by the ancient Buddhists, is sense pleasure. That offers the most immediate solution. I'm suffering, eat some bread. Chocolate, maybe. Chocolate stands for a great deal. Everybody can put into chocolate whatever is their own sense poison. So yes, sense pleasure is the most obvious compromise that we make, where instead of really facing up to things, you sort of palliate your discomfort by some sort of sense pleasure. Not that there's anything wrong with enjoying the senses. and especially the senses when they are refined and sublimated. But sense pleasure in the end is for us a trap, because it seems to offer some sort of final permanent resolution of the pressures that build inside us as unresolved human beings. We're all unfinished, so that the pressures within us are still boiling away, and we seek means of discharging those pressures, which are all merely palliations. It just lets the steam out for a little, and then it builds up again. So sense pleasure is one. Of course, wealth, success, power. Power is a tremendous sort of temptation, because it seems as if once you have power, you can control suffering. You can get it under control. You can determine what happens. You can't, of course. Of course you can't. Spending a lot of time in India, you see much more of sort of naked power grabbing. In Britain, we're so genteel about power. I mean, we don't really have politics here, for instance. We have no idea what politics are in Britain. In India, they have real politics. In other countries too. I don't know, in Britain we've sort of chosen a very bland form of politics. Maybe it's a good thing. Like, in Spain, was it José María Aznar promised to make politics boring in Spain? Well, we've done it here. We've achieved it. But in India, there's real politics. Politics matters. And there's real naked power. For instance, I talked to people in India about, was it Peter Mandelson who had to resign from the cabinet because he'd borrowed money from another cabinet minister and hadn't declared it? And he said, what? You mean he hadn't, stolen £1 billion and etc.? They just can't understand how that can be a problem. I felt rather proud of being British. Power seems to offer the solution. And of course, we've all got our own ways of grabbing at power, of finding ways to get things under our control. And techno freaks, I've taken a vow of technological brahmacharya. I leave it to Dhammachalin to get the technology. But technology is such a temptation. You think, you've got the faster doodah or what's it. What was it? I've heard something. There's something, a P-phone or...
iPhone.
Apparently, there's a new iPhone coming. And that new iPhone really will control reality. And suffering will be completely abolished once you've got it. There's no doubt. It's true. Dhammadina can advance. So, power through technology. That's a tremendous temptation for us here. Success, wealth, and so on. All of these are ways in which we think we can solve the fundamental dilemma, the fundamental problems of life. That's Mara. Mara's coming to us and offering us these opportunities. Come here, if you buy this, you really will be happy. And so on. Health, ordinary happiness, psychological health, that can be a quest that is unending. Not that any of these things are bad in themselves, if you see what I mean. But we attach to them as ends, and we devote all this wonderful energy that we've got as human beings to the pursuit of these. We most of us, I think, are not very naked in our quest of these things. It's more a question of adjusting. Something I find fascinating, spending so much time in India, where people have to put up with really quite horrific conditions. And I really enjoy Westerners coming out who are less adapted than me and watching the amount of energy they put into sort of tweaking things, just slightly adjusting things. So that, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, move this here, move that there, do this, go there, buy this, buy that, all to adjust yourself so that you're minimally, fractionally more comfortable. Indians just can't understand it. They probably err too much in the other direction, to be frank, but that's another question. Most of our, what Mara more offers us than, this is the complete solution is, just do that and you'll be a little bit happier. And that will be good. Amara mainly comes as to in a very sort of gentlemanly form, very polite and very indirect, not the sort of out and out attack that the Buddha got, because you have to make a lot of effort for Mara to get big and serious, as it were. The more serious you are about resolving this fundamental problem of life, the more serious Mara becomes. So when the Buddha talks about Mara's attack in terms of the seductiveness of the daughters and the violence of the sons, we're talking about somebody who means business and for whom Mara has to pull out all his stops. So Mara represents not really facing up to the fundamental disquiet that is in the heart of all of us, because we've not resolved what our consciousness is, what it is to be alive. We've not worked out how best to live this life for the good of ourselves and of others. We're left with constant sort of wrong note, which does not allow us to relax, to enjoy fully. So we Mara represents the false solutions to the problem. The real solutions up to a certain point. And, to quote a famous aphorism of Sangharakshita, the good is the enemy of the best. Often good things take us from what is best. We satisfy ourselves with less than the best. So it's something we need to be very, very careful of in our own spiritual lives. We can't, get to the Bodhi tree in a single bound, but we need to be careful that we don't just lose our way to Buddha Gaya by seeking, comfortable way stations, you could say. So yes, Mara attacks, but the Buddha is proof against that. All these sort of temptations to find lesser solutions, he sees through. He sees through them. It's not that he fights them. It's not that he says, oh no. He just says, well, what's the point? What's the point of wealth? You should only go again. What's the point of success? You only lose it. What's the point of health even? You're going to die. So he sees through them. Mara has no hold on him. With us, we have to be much more wide awake, because we've all of us perhaps got our moments of, or our areas of temptation or areas of weakness, but the Buddha didn't have that. So he escaped the clutches of Mara. Mara could do nothing to him. He didn't fight Mara, he just sort of saw through him, and that ended Mara's power. And as the morning star rose in the sky, from the Bodhi tree, the way he was facing, the morning star does come up immediately in front of you. Venus rises, and is it Venus? Yes. And at that moment, light arose in his mind. He saw, what it says is he saw that everything arises in dependence on conditions. Unfortunately, the words themselves don't do it, do they? But what the words signify is a recognition of the fundamental conditioned nature of experience, and the fact that there's nothing in experience that stays still. There's nothing that is capable of being held and grasped and added to you and taken away with you. So there's, you just let it go, you let it flow, watch for the positive trends within it, move with the positive trends within it, but fundamentally be free from it. Free to move with it. So the Buddha saw that everything is impermanent. He saw that there is no essences in reality, outside or inside. Everything is simply conditioned. He saw that suffering comes from clinging to these impermanent things. So the sort of recitation of the words doesn't capture the experience, of course, because we have to replicate that for ourselves. But what we're told is that on seeing this, he released all tension, all suffering, all clinging. and he experienced the bliss of freedom. That's what it's what's discussed. And he just sat under that tree for 7 full days, experiencing the bliss of freedom. Nothing could touch him anymore. Nothing could disturb him. He'd seen the solution to the problem. Not just seen the solution to the problem, you could almost say he'd become the solution to the problem. After that first week, he got up and he moved, not very far, it's about 50 yards. The place is still marked just above the Mahabodhi temple. And the goat herd's banyan, I think it's called. He sat under another tree. And it's really interesting. He sat and gazed at the Bodhi tree. He gazed with unblinking eyes, we're told, for one whole week, looking at the Bodhi tree. And what he was experiencing was intense gratitude. I think absolutely wonderful that he gained enlightenment. He'd resolved the fundamental issue of life. And what he experienced was great gratitude. Gratitude to the tree, presumably in a way that because the tree represented everything that had supported him, everything that had helped him, everything that had led him on his way. And he just sat there gazing at the tree. And this is now a practice that all Buddhists are recommended to undertake. And I took this practice myself. Not unblinking, I'm sorry. But just to gaze at the tree and through the tree to express one's gratitude to everything that had brought about this momentous change in history when freedom, real freedom, inner freedom, the highest freedom came into the world. So the Buddha sat feeling gratitude. Even a Buddha feels gratitude. Or you could say even especially a Buddha feels gratitude because he recognises his dependence on other things as a human being. He recognises everything that has supported and helped him on his way, including that tree. Later tradition says that tree was full of devas, full of gods and goddesses. And even the tree itself was a goddess. And so it's sort of personified in the form of these spirits. A lot one could say about trees and spirits, but this is not the moment. After that, after 1 week there, I'm sorry to say so little about it, but it's such an evocative event, I'd like to spend much more time on it. I suppose what it perhaps says to us is that, well, we need to share in that gratitude to the extent that we've made any spiritual progress. We need to share in that gratitude. We need to experience that gratitude ourselves to the Buddha, to everything that supported him, and to everything that's brought the Dhamma to us. If you don't experience gratitude, you cannot value. It's quite straightforward. If you don't value something, well, you won't feel gratitude. If you don't feel gratitude, you will not value. Do you see what I mean? That gratitude and value are intimately connected. So if you feel no gratitude, it's because you do not value. And I think this is something that we have to work quite hard against with our rather cynical culture. The culture of denigration and so forth. Of course, we don't want credulity, we don't want hypocrisy, and so forth. But we must value. If we do not value, we cannot aspire. And if we don't aspire, we cannot escape suffering. And yes, gratitude is a natural consequence of holding value. For instance, you come to the centre here. It's got its faults. I know, I'm the president, it's my duty to spot them. I'll be giving Paramabandhu a list of later. yes, got its faults, of course it has. But it's through this that many of you have come in contact with the Dhamma. Because this centre exists, that you've come in contact with the Dhamma. It's because Sangharakshita returned to the West and started the FWBO that you've come in contact with the Dhamma in this form, in this way, in such an appropriate way. I was very, very moved. I was reading one of the Mitra's to be's description of her journey, and she described how, well, from a Chinese background, perhaps here today, and had was appreciating as a functioning within the Western culture and having left behind a Chinese cultural Buddhism, appreciating the way in which Sangharakshita had made the Dhamma live in this modern Western world. So if we don't value that, we won't take advantage of it. We won't use it. It won't help us. It won't take us forward. It's absolutely straightforward. Without feeling, you cannot do anything. So if you don't feel for the Dhamma, if you don't feel for the form in which it comes to you, with all its warts and warts, it won't work for you. It just will not work. So gratitude is absolutely basic to spiritual life. And it doesn't mean credulity, it doesn't mean disguising faults and so forth. It means just appreciating what you've got and those who've given it to you and how it's come to you. And the Buddha exemplified that even after enlightenment to a supreme degree, one whole week of gratitude. Then he came down the little hill to just beside where the Mahabodhi temple is now, and he just walked up and down for one whole week. The Ratana Chankana, Chankamana, or Chankramana in Sanskrit. The jewelled walking place. And I think what's going on here, it's difficult to say exactly, but my impression is that the Buddha had had a momentous experience which changed everything. But he hadn't yet worked out all the implications. He hadn't seen what it really meant to him, how it sort of filtered through. We tend to think of the Enlightenment as a sort of single experience, and everything's different from that point. Well, it is different from that point on, but it hasn't been completed. The process hasn't been completed. So he's seen the real nature of things, and the pennies are dropping one by one, if I can use so prosaic an image. He's seeing more and more of the implications of what's happened to him, more and more deeply what it means for him. What it means for not just him, what it means for life, for all living things. So he's walking up and down, perhaps not sort of thinking in words, more sort of digesting. That's what I think of it as, sort of spiritual digestion, transcendental digestion, where what's happened is sort of, well, like food, you eat it and then you make it part of your metabolism. You metabolize it and make it part of your body. I'm suddenly aware I've got a doctor sitting there. you make it part of you. So, he's sort of metabolising the experience that he's had, making it part of him. So again, it's very, very interesting, isn't it, that, you sometimes think of the Buddha sort of, taking off his Clark Kent suit and appearing with a big B on the front. And that's it. From then on, he can control the universe. But it's not really like that, apparently. He takes off his tie and then he takes... No. It just sort of gradually, he's changed. He's transformed as sinks deeper and deeper into him. Then for the next, the fourth week, he spends a week again meditating. And obviously what's going on here is... very deep psychic repercussions of what's happened. It's said that he sort of manifested a jewelled chamber, the Ratanagara, a chamber, a little sort of kuti, a little hut made of jewels. And clearly we're in the realm of psychic experience, of mystical experience, if you like. Very often connected with that sort of image of jewels, isn't it? Jewels which... somehow earthly, but at the same time they reflect something of another dimension. I remember seeing a diamond once, and you look into the centre of the diamond, it's alive, it's got a fire within it that is from another dimension. So this jewelled chamber that the Buddha sat in was his absorbing himself in this other dimension. And it's said that his body then manifested six rays of light. And it's worth just visiting this because it's quite important for modern Buddhists. A blue light, yellow light, red light, white light, orange light, and a light that was a mixture of the other five. And these are the colours of the Buddhist flag that you've probably seen. Those of you who've been to India will see it in many, many places. It's universally used, except at the LBC. There should be a Buddhist flag here. I hereby declare as your president. So this flag was actually invented by an American, of course, an American theosophist, Colonel Olcott, who's an associate of Madame Blavatsky. But it's been taken up all over the Buddhist world as the Buddhist flag. And it's the colours of the Buddha's aura as he sat in that Ratnagara. And each of the colours has a meaning, but it depends which book you read what meaning they have. But they clearly indicate spiritual qualities, spiritual virtues that the Buddha radiated from his body as he sat in this elevated state where, as I say, the sort of psychic repercussions, not the intellectual, not the theoretical repercussions, but the psychic repercussions of this experience filtered through. And it's said that at this point he was able to visit other worlds, that he ceased to be bound by his mere physical existence. He was no longer identified himself, in other words, just with the physical body. You know, we usually think of ourselves as physical being first and some sort of mind after that. But this is not really the case, if you like. We exist on many other levels. And a Buddha, and indeed other beings too, have the capacity to sort of journey through those realms of imagination, you might call them. But here, let's talk of imagination in a... not merely a dismissive way. Imagination as real experience of other dimensions of life, of being. So the Buddha absorbed himself in his meditative experience and travelled, journeyed from the heights to the depths of the universe, saw it in all its manifold wonder and awfulness. After that week, he travelled just a few yards to a point just in front of the Mahabodhi temple. There's a pillar there, the Ajapala tree. And he sat there, absorbed in meditation. It's really interesting, it goes from tree to tree, but that's another question. It's fascinating to me. But it goes from tree to tree, and each tree has its own sort of flavour and significance. So he's sitting under the Ajapala tree, and he has his first encounter. This is really interesting. The first person he meets after his enlightenment is a Brahmin. Now, of course, in Indian religion, in common Indian religion, in modern Hinduism, the Brahmin has a very special place. The Brahmin is known in modern Hindi and so forth as Bhudeva, an earthly god. The Brahmin is a sort of... well, it's not even a priest in the sense of being a intermediary. The Brahmin is sort of more like descended from another level. And it's the highest being on this earth, according to classical Indian tradition. So the Brahmin is the one who can perform the Vedic rites. Those Vedic rites are necessary to a successful life. So, and this is still the case today. Although the theology is a little different, it's still fundamentally the case today. So a Brahmin, if you don't have the blessings of a Brahmin, if you don't have the help of a Brahmin, you cannot lead a successful life. So the Brahmin here represents the old scale of values, the old system of values, not just the old system of values, the old social system. So the Buddha comes into direct contact with and immediate confrontation with the old system in its sort of rawest form. Fascinating. This is his first encounter. And it shows the revolutionary, the radical nature of the Buddha's insight. So the Brahmin sees him sitting there. There's always a tension between the Brahmins in the scriptures and the Buddhist ascetics, because the ascetics are sort of invading the territory of the Brahmins. So there's a sort of natural conflict between them. So when this Brahmin, whose name is Huhunka, and some people have pointed out that Huhunka is a sort of an onomatopoeic. He's a sort of haughty blighter. Shut up. Huhunka Jati, Huhunka, comes to the Buddha and says, what are you doing there? Who are you? You're not a Brahmin. How dare you sit there meditating? In other words, invading my sort of prerogative. And so he asks the key question. He says, well, what is it that makes a Brahmin? What constitutes a Brahmin? What is a Brahmin? So the Brahmin is the supreme being of the old system. It's the highest value of the old system. So he's challenging the Buddha. Naturally, in his mind, the answer is quite clear. What makes a Brahmin is to be born a Brahmin. Not just to be born a Brahmin, but to go through the proper rites, be twice born, and so on and so forth. But fundamentally, it's to be born a Brahmin. So, this has got not just religious implications, but social implications. It's a social system where birth makes privilege. Where because you're born into a certain caste, community, class, race, whatever it is, you're tops. And it's natural. So don't think this is just about India. This is about everywhere. This is about the whole world. The world is governed by these sort of social systems everywhere, here too. There's assumptions about who's the best and who's not. Unspoken, often spoken very loudly, but often not openly acknowledged in the public discourse. But nonetheless, there, very much there in India today. I know because my strongest identification is with people who are still treated as untouchable in many parts of India. I'm spending a lot of time some time in Hungary, and there my contact is with gypsies, who are even worse situation in many ways than untouchables in India. You've got a social system there in which there are Brahmins. In Hungary, it's all the white people. India, it's the twice born, the top two or three castes, and especially the Brahmins, even today. So, the question is, what makes a Brahmin? Is it birth? The Buddha says no, a resounding no. He says it's not birth that makes you a Brahmin, it's not ritual that makes you a Brahmin, it's being without conceit, not being puffed up, not being proud of yourself in a false way. It's having got rid of all unskillful behaviour. It's being free from mental defilements, mental turbulence. It's being controlled in yourself, not being reactive, simply indulging yourself. It's being wise in the sense of understanding the way life really is. It's having completed the holy life. The spiritual path. It's having no intoxication with anything in this world, not being tempted by any of these false solutions. That's what a Brahmin is. So the Buddha revalues both the social and religious system of India at that point. He conducts what has later been called a Dhamma revolution. He revolutionizes Indian society. That revolution, unfortunately, didn't succeed. It lasted for 400 or 500 years, but the old system reasserted itself. And it's only from 1956 onwards that the counter-revolution has taken place again. The revaluation of values. What Buddhism has most to offer the world is new values. Values which are human values, not ethnic values, not partial values, not class values, not values of worldly wealth and success, values of ethical living, ethical life, and spiritual insight. That is what Buddhism offers the world. It confronts the corruptions, the oppressions, the unhappiness, the misery of the world with a true scale of values, a human scale of values. That's what the Buddha. The first thing he did, he launched that Dhamma revolution. And I think this is a very, very important point for us, still, even in Britain. That Dhamma revolution is needed here as much as in India or Hungary. We don't face quite the same sort of rigidities. We have our own. But I think probably one of the issues that we really need to confront is the the false values in terms of a narrow consumerist materialism, apart from the political systems that we have to confront. We have to try to offer to this society here a new idea of what it is to be a human being that goes beyond our differences, that goes beyond our distinctions. I think it's fascinating, this whole debate about what it is to be British. It clearly isn't warm beer and cricket on the green anymore. Pace, John Major. Who likes warm beer anyway? And everybody else plays cricket so much better than we do. Where are these values to be found? And it seems to me that we, as Buddhists, have something very, very important to say about human values, which I don't hear being loudly proclaimed. And I'd like to think that a centre like this was not merely dealing with the nice people who come along and want to slightly adjust their personalities. I'm just going to insult you a bit just to get you going. We want to be changing this society, changing this world. It's not good enough. It's not productive of happiness. It's not fair. We live in this country on the poverty of others. It's still the case. I spend so much time in India now that I can see it so clearly. And of course, the ancestral history, as it were, the imperial legacy of Britain is poverty in India. So, we can't just leave it unconfronted. That's what the Buddha's saying to us when he speaks to Huhunka. He says, it's not good enough. Spiritual values, ethical values, are the most important thing. That's what determines what is a good person or not. Not whether somebody has a lively personality. Our heroes today are so shallow. It's so fleeting. We really need to be trying to present to the world a new scale of values which can not merely give people a much better life in the psychological and spiritual sense, but can transform society. So it's more just, more free, more equitable. The Buddha launched a Dhamma revolution. It wasn't just a personal spiritual sort of message. I think we so often in the West take it like that. Again, it's a bit shocking to me now because I've become a third Indian. And, the perspective there is so different. And I think we're too complacent, too selfish, too wrapped up in our own happiness. And actually, what we've got is what can help the world, what can save the world. Hallelujah. If we can really get this scale of values that the Buddha has given us out into the world, we can really help. We can make a contribution. So I'd like to see the LBC not just having a new roof in the courtyard, but expanding out into a real influence in society. This is what we joined the revolution for. This is what we were here for. We wanted to change society. We thought it was going to come. Seems, the 60s generation, we thought we were ushering in a new era. All we were doing was bringing better shopping. Choice. And the LBC. So the Buddha confronts the old system, and we need to confront the old system. We must not compromise with it. We must challenge it at its heart with new spiritual and moral values that are human and that offer a real life, satisfying life for everybody. So the story goes on. The Buddha moved from that tree after a whole week sitting there, confronting Huhunka. I think Huhunka went off thoroughly dissatisfied. He didn't hear what he wanted to hear. But don't worry. Huhunka was influenced, and later he became a monk. So you see, it works in the end. So yes, then the Buddha went to another tree. It began to rain extremely heavily. We're getting really mystical here. Very strong thunder and lightning. The Buddha took refuge under a tree called the Mukalinda tree, which was by a great lake. And as he sat there, out of the lake came a huge cobra, the king cobra, the Raja of the snakes, Mukalinda himself, Naga King, Naga Raja, and the king of the snakes wrapped himself round the Buddha 7 times, so the story goes, and opened his hood over the Buddha's head, sheltering him from the rain. So you get a rather quaint sort of picture of the Buddha sitting, it looks like a coil of rope, with his head just sticking over the top, and a snake's head over the top, like an umbrella. A little comical. But he's sitting there, protected from the shower of rain by the Buddha, and he gives voice to a wonderful sort of paean of joy. He says, "Happy are the contented." Contented, that is, who don't want anything, who've got everything they want. They're happy. Happiness is for those who hear and know the truth. That's where happiness comes from. So again, it's a revaluation. Happiness doesn't come from possession. Happiness doesn't come from position. Happiness comes from hearing and knowing the truth. When you hear and know the truth, you are free, you are happy. Happy are those with Maitri. Happy are those who feel love for all other beings. Because to feel hatred is to be miserable, is to be suffering. But when you feel Maitri, you feel happy. Happy are those free from attachment, who are beyond sense desires. Yes, they can enjoy the senses, but there's no stickiness. They're not caught up with them. You just let them go again. Because when you're attached, craving arises, and craving is dissatisfaction. And the highest happiness is getting rid of all self-clinging, all the illusion that you are a separate, permanent I. That's the real happiness. So the Buddha sits there in this state of bliss. The 7 coils to me suggest the kundalini, the 7 chakras. So you could say it represents the completion of the process. The enlightenment experience has now filtered through every part of his being. And he's fully integrated with it, with that experience. And he's nothing but bliss, nothing but understanding. So lastly, he spends 7 days in another tree, which is quite near the Bodhi tree, the Rajayatana tree. And while he's sitting there, again experiencing the bliss of release, isn't it wonderful? He's just sitting there, completely happy, nothing to do, no imperative upon him, no time. He apparently hasn't eaten for 7 weeks, as far as we know. And he's just completely happy, completely at ease. But at that point, the world comes to him in the form of 2 merchants. They're 2 merchants who are from Orissa, which is in left, right-hand side of it, eastern India, just below Bengal. They're carrying goods back home, and they're drawn into the woods. They sort of see something or feel something. They're drawn into the woods, and there they see this extraordinary figure. It must have been a real sight because, you know, he hadn't washed, presumably, for 7 days, 7 weeks. He hadn't shaved, he hadn't combed his hair. He was wearing rag robes. He's probably fairly thin by that time. And in very, very intense. And he must have just shone with his spiritual realization, but just sort of glowed with spiritual realization. So they knew they were in the presence of something absolutely remarkable. First of all, they were terrified. So they sort of asked, well, you know, who are you? Are you a deva? Because, of course, that, you know, are you a spirit? Are you a ghost? But the Buddha says, no, I'm the ascetic Gotama. So they then start to engage with him. The Buddha begins to tell them a bit about his achievement. And they're deeply, deeply moved. And they bow down before him. They go for refuge to him and to his Dhamma. There isn't a Sangha yet, so they can't go for refuge to the Sangha, but they go for refuge to the Buddha himself and to his teaching. They're the first disciples, the first converts, and they feed him. The very interesting fact about this is that, India did die out everywhere in India, apart from the Himalayan region and the northeast up towards the Burmese border. There's still Buddhists, presumably from ancient times there. But in Orissa, there are 20 villages where the people consider themselves Buddhists. They think that the Buddha is an incarnation of Vishnu, so they're sort of Hinduized Buddhists, but they call themselves Buddhists. And, well, now we've got three Dhamma Mitras from those Buddhists who are descendants of Tapusa and Bhalika, the first people to be converted by the Buddha. So it's a wonderful sort of completion of the circle. Very, very interesting. They're not very fond of Dr. Ambedkar, but that's another question because they're high caste. Anyway, they're changing. So the final point of this whole sort of 7 weeks is the Buddha turning out towards the world. He's had this extraordinary experience that's totally transformed him, that has filtered all the way through him, that's transformed him on every level, the most sort of strange and rarefied dimensions of imagination are completely transformed. He's thoroughly sort of thought through or mused through the experience that he's had. He's confronted the old system. He's established his system as a new one that rejects the fundamental premises of the old. And now he sets out on his mission. He goes from Bodh Gaya, he goes to Varanasi and then to Saranath, and he finds his old disciples and he starts teaching. And the rest is history. Not just history, the rest is us. We are the end result of that history. But we're not the end result, of course. We're just another stage in that history. Because it's come to us because of the countless millions of people who, after Tapusa and Bhalika, have absorbed the Buddha's message, gone for refuge to the Buddha, practiced his teaching, and taught it to others. Millions and millions of people stand between us and the Buddha, and we will stand amongst those millions for people in the future. This is real. You know, I was one of those who founded this centre. The first person to see it. And I was involved very strongly with setting it up. For so many years, I haven't done much here. For 5 years, I've done nothing here. Many of you I've never seen before. But because I made my contribution at that time, you're here. Not just me, of course, but I'm just pointing out my particular role, if you see what I mean, so you can see your role in the future. It's because people have dedicated themselves to the Buddha, because they've gone for refuge to him, because they've absorbed his teaching, practiced it and taught it to others, shared it with others, made it available. You don't even have to teach. You can just help, make the tea, whatever. Other people will gain the Dhamma, and this Dhamma revolution will pass beyond us to more and more people. So the story doesn't end with us. We're simply another link in the chain that goes on into the future, and that there are people in the future who will practice the Dhamma because of you, because of what you've done, because of the contribution you've made. There are people who will practice the Dhamma and find a solution to the deep dissatisfaction they feel. You will contribute to this Dhamma revolution that the Buddha initiated 2,500 years ago. So this is something for us all to think very deeply about. What happened then was the pivotal point in history. But it's not complete. The Buddha confronted Huhunka, but Huhunka still lives. There's Huhunka everywhere in society. There's Huhunka everywhere, all around us. We're Huhunka sometimes. And the old system goes on in new forms. New forms of social oppression, new forms of exploitation, new forms of exclusion, and so on. New forms of unhappiness, new false solutions are constructed every day. And it's for us to make our offering, our contribution to changing that. And the LBC is a remarkable institution for that. It's done so much already. Thousands of people have learned meditation here. And hundreds of thousands will learn in the future, especially if you make it even bigger and even grander. So these are the reflections that I have on meeting the Buddha. We meet the Buddha. In meeting the Buddha, we need to understand what the Buddha really is. And we need to recognize our gratitude to the Buddha and the obligation of gratitude, if you see what I mean. It's not obligation in the sort of remote authority sense. It's that your gratitude evokes in you a desire to contribute, a desire to serve, a desire to make your offering. And every one of us can do that. However new we are, however old we are, we can make our contribution, and we do. So let's hope that the LBC continues to be inspired by those 7 weeks that changed the world, that really did change the world and can change it so much more. And all of us make our contribution to it. So thank you very much.